Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, and we are joined by my fellow editor-at-large of the Bulwark, Bill Kristol. Thanks for coming back on, Bill. Appreciate it very much. Good to talk with you.
My pleasure, Charlie.
Hey, it was a big morning for the Bulwark. I was on Stephanie Ruhle's show, and so was A.B. Stoddard, and she was talking about her amazing piece about Lev Parnas and the ticking time bomb, that whole case was for the Republicans. So it was a good Bulwark morning.
Well, that's good to hear. The last week, really, last two months, but it's really been, there's been some terrific stuff. I mean, the last couple of days, though, the AB's piece, your piece, suggesting, you know, to hold the impeachment possibly. Jeff Julis and I had the piece about working on the Senate side to get
you were on Morning Joe talking about that.
Yeah. To get an actual real trial in the Senate. Jonathan Last has a fantastic piece people should look at this morning on, you know, will the Trump control of the GOP last beyond November, even if Trump loses? Mm-hmm. Very little disheartening, but, you know, as John McCain said, it's always darkest until it turns pitch black. So,
yeah, I would suggest
that's where we are. Kind of
people read Jonathan's piece and then have a stiff drink.
Exactly. Have a stiff drink, read the piece, and then have another stiff drink. That would be my recommendation.
So you and I are talking within moments of Mitch McConnell basically saying, yeah, I'm not going to agree to have any witnesses. Certainly seems like he's trending toward a quick trial without a single witness, a single witness testifying before the Senate. Your thoughts about that? Because we have a new poll out showing that 70% of Americans think that the administration should let aides testify, and of course that's apparently not going to be happening.
Well, we'll see if it's going to be happening, because, you know, Mitch McConnell, unlike in the normal procedures of the Senate where he's the majority leader and he's got pretty much automatic support from his party, this is a little unusual. They're sitting as a court of impeachment. The rules will have to be passed by 51 senators. And the real question, and this is the question for the Senate trial, I think, and it will be resolved over the next couple of weeks, is does every Republican senator simply go along with what Mitch McConnell wants? Or do some of them say, well, wait a second, can't we have a negotiation and agree to some rules for some witnesses, you know, who could testify maybe by on video camera or by deposition if people think it's too embarrassing or disruptive to have them actually appear before the Senate, though that's not such a big deal, obviously, and have them questioned by both the House managers, who are the prosecution, and the defense attorneys of President Trump. I mean, we have trials in this country every day, and witnesses appear and get questioned by prosecutors and defense attorneys, and it seems not to be an impossible thing to do. The idea that senators can't sit there like any jury would sit there and listen to such a examination and cross-examination, that this would be something that would be such a burden on the American public or on the senators themselves, is a little ludicrous. So I am not so sure that McConnell can get away with simply getting a party line vote on his preferred rules.
Okay, so you wrote with Jeff Tullis over the weekend calling for a constitutional caucus, pointing out that only a very small number of Republicans need to basically say, we want a full, fair trial, to basically say to Mitch McConnell, we are not going along with all this. This seems like a very doable thing to have. I think it would be four senators who would have to basically say, we're going to side with the Democrats and we're going to come up with rules that are not going to turn this into a sham trial. So what specifically would you be looking for if Mitt Romney calls you up in 5 minutes and says, okay, Bill, I want to form this constitutional caucus. What is our agenda? What is our ask?
So I've spoken to some senators and some staff, both parties actually, since then. I think the way it would work is probably the Republicans wouldn't simply defect to the Democrats. That seems a little too partisan the other way. What you might get is a group of four Republicans and four Democratic senators. Let's just say, I'm semi-making this up, but, you know, Mitt Romney and Susan Collins and Lamar Alexander and a couple of others on the Republican side, and the Democrats who have some history of working across the aisle, the Michael Bennets or the Chris Coonses or others on the Democratic side, getting together. And as they've done on some other issues, incidentally, you'd have a gang of six or eight or 10 or whatever. And they would say, look, to both parties, we want this to be a serious, sober process. Let's work out rules. And what they did in 1998, 99 with the Clinton trial is they had X number of witnesses on each side, X number of hours for their examination and cross-examination. They preferred not to, because it was Sachs and Lewinsky and stuff, they preferred not to have the witnesses appear before the Senate. I think in this case, there's no reason they shouldn't appear live. Look, the senators don't really run the trial. I mean, House Schumer suggested in his letter the other day witnesses he would like to see, but it's really not his business to select the witnesses. That's up to the House managers. They might say, we've made our case. We don't need any witnesses. We know that I think they would like to have a few. And incidentally, Trump claims he wants to have witnesses, and Trump's lawyers can call those witnesses. And I would, maybe the Chief Justice who's presiding would say, well, that witness seems not to be relevant, just the way a judge might say, you know, we don't need Charlie Sykes here testifying in a trial about which he has no, you know, an incident about which he wasn't involved and about which he has no knowledge. Or they might say, okay, you have whoever you want. And maybe it would be a bit of a spectacle if Trump's lawyers insist on calling Hunter Biden and, I don't know, Adam Schiff. But on the other hand, we could put up with that. And honestly, I would say, let them decide. He's the president. He's entitled to his own defense. So the key here is the senators remember that they're setting up the rules for the Senate as a court of impeachment. It's not normal business. Once they sit, they take a fresh oath as a court. The senators, as senators, have to set the rules. If you want to think of an analogy, legislatures, state legislatures, or the national legislature, Congress, pass the rules of how, generally speaking, of how trials will work and so forth, right, what the penalties are. And then the actual court proceeding proceeds according to certain rules that have been written down ahead of time and agreed to. So that's the situation we should want to have. We want to have as much of a dignified and trial with as much bipartisan support for the basic rules as possible. And for me, what McConnell and Lindsey Graham and some of the others are saying really is extraordinary, that they are saying ahead of time. It's one thing to say I'm inclined to think, or I strongly think that I'm going to vote to acquit. That's fine. This is not like a real jury where you have, you know, you rule out the jurors who have a preconception. So the fact that Elizabeth Warren thinks she's going to vote to convict and Ted Cruz thinks he's going to vote to acquit, that's fine. And they can make that argument on TV and to their fellow senators. That's one thing. It's another thing to say ahead of time, we, the jury, are going to limit what the prosecution and the defense can even say on their own part or the witnesses they can call. That's not acceptable in a real trial, and it shouldn't be acceptable here. So I think the key would be to modified my thinking since the original article. I think it's really key for a bipartisan group of senators to get together and say, we have some notions about how a trial could be set up. They're probably going to be based on the Clinton trial of 98, 99. But what we mostly have a notion about is that the two parties need to get together and work out these rules for a trial, and let's get a bipartisan majority, maybe not unanimity, in how what these rules will be. And they should include some witnesses, in my view. And then you go ahead and have a real trial. And maybe it takes 4 weeks instead of 2 weeks, and that makes Mitch McConnell unhappy, but so what?
Okay, so you and I agree, and we disagree on this. I agree absolutely in what you're describing, the Constitutional Caucus and the role that it can play and exactly what it should ask for. I think we agree on that. Where I think we disagree is that I think that this is something that the House Democrats, including Nancy Pelosi, need to keep in mind. They're going to vote tomorrow to impeach the president. There's no requirement, as Lawrence Tribe has been pointing out, that they immediately send it over to the Senate. I have suggested that in order to get leverage so that we do what you are describing, that Nancy Pelosi says, we will send it over as soon as we have some sort of an assurance that this is not going to be a show trial. But you think that's a gimmick?
Well, I think it's reasonable. I'm open-minded. Yeah, I'm open-minded to it, honestly, in the sense of if it increases leverage for a gang of 8 or 10 or 12 in the Senate to sort of get a reasonable trial. There's a bit of a chicken and egg. Does the House say that ahead of time? I think, let me put it this way. I very much agree with you that if I were in House leadership over the next 48 hours, I would be saying, look, we want a real trial in the Senate. We've done our duty here. People can criticize some of the ways in which we've acted, but that's sort of irrelevant at this point. We want the Senate, if the senators think we didn't act properly, they should then show us how to act even better, right? So I kind of agree with you that the House should make that case, whether they should literally hold up the articles of impeachment and sort of not send them. I'm sort of open-minded on that, I guess. I would sort of make it clear that you're doing this for the sake of having a fair trial, not because you think it's impossible to have a fair trial.
Exactly.
You don't want to undercut the Democrats in the Senate who are working with Republicans to try to bring some Republicans in the Senate over. That's my only concern with the way it was formulated originally.
Okay, so here's the real clear and present danger. And I think that, you know, President Trump's use of his power to dig up dirt on a political opponent to extort the Ukrainians, that his behavior is this is an ongoing crime. This is a crime in progress. And it is crucial to recognize this is what is why I think that the House should go ahead and impeach. But I also think it's a real it's a clear and present danger that the president and his supporters want to have a quickie Senate trial that he will cast as pure exoneration. And I'm trying to imagine what a president, I know it's actually easy to imagine what a President Trump who has been acquitted, who claims complete exoneration, the way in which he would feel emboldened and empowered. That Donald Trump, the day after that Senate vote, poses a different danger because it's very clear, given Rudy Giuliani's behavior, that the president is not deterred in any way from his conduct. And I'm not sure that the Democrats have or other, you know, principled Republicans have a plan B that once the ultimate check and balance has been removed, what do you do with an absolutely unaccountable President Donald Trump?
Look, I think this is why 2020 is such a scary year, honestly, because either way, if the House ever sends over the articles, Trump says, see, they didn't even have the nerve to send them over. It was just symbolic, right. Just nonsense. Mm-hmm. Or if they send them over and the Republicans just insist on a sham trial with 51 votes, I agree, that's also bad. So then Trump says, basically, no one touched me. I'm clear. What's the expression? I'm looking for scot free, yeah. Or whatever. But any which way Trump gets off is bad in the sense that I think he's emboldened. If there are five actual Republican votes against him on final to convict, and he gets only a minority of the Senate that saves him in office, that makes it much better, I think. If there are 10 or 15 votes by Republicans to convict, that's even better. But I agree. And I think in that respect, all the rest of us, including the House Democrats, but also any decent Republicans in the Senate, I mean, people really need to get serious at that point about the institutions of government and preserving them and strengthening them over the next year. One thing I've always been very worried about is, what if the Russians just, okay, go crazy interfering? Just do what they've been doing. Or do what they did in 2016. Let's make it simple. The Director of National Intelligence comes to a Donald Trump who's been acquitted, let's say, even acquitted maybe after a reasonable trial in summer of 2016 and says, hey, we got a real problem here, Mr. Trump. The Russians are intervening. Trump says, I don't believe you. DNI says, well, I think we need to warn the public about this in terms of what's happening on social media and so forth, or warn the other campaign. And Trump says, nope, you can't do that. I mean, I do think the degree to which we are now in an ongoing crisis almost for the whole next year, depending on Trump's behavior in terms of his running the government, we're going to be, will people then go public? Will there be further whistleblowers? There should be if Trump tells the Director of National Intelligence he can't talk about what the Russians are doing. But I agree, Trump will be both emboldened and he'll feel like he can use the resources and the institutions of government as part of his reelection campaign. And that is very dangerous.
What do you make of Rudy Giuliani's behavior? He comes back and now he is in full-fledged attack mode against Marie Yovanovitch. Look, I mean, I think this is just a blizzard of bullshit coming from Rudy Giuliani, but in terms of it, this being an ongoing conspiracy. And also, you know, A.B. Stoddard's article the other day, which sort of reminds us that this is an ongoing, unfolding scandal where you have Lev Parnas, who is in court, I believe, back in court today, you know, is clearly is you know, getting money from the Russians and then is paying Rudy Giuliani. There are so many connections here. There are so many aspects of this that could become much worse. And obviously, one of the reasons why Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham want to get the trial over is because they want to have it over before whatever's happening in the SDNY explodes. But just give me your thoughts on Rudy Giuliani. I mean, is this crazy? Is it crazy like a fox? What?
I mean, probably a little of both of those, but I agree with what you've been writing, what AB has been writing, Jonathan Last. I mean, the media who is just saying, whoa, that Rudy, he's really wacky. He's hurting. Doesn't he realize he's hurting Trump? Baloney. Even if he takes some hits on this from the media or whatever, to the degree he gets away with this, it's helping Trump. It's helping embolden Trump, and it's helping embolden foreign governments, incidentally, to intervene in 2020. Mm-hmm. It's helping embolden another 10 or 50 Lev Parnases to find 10 or 50 other Rudy Giulianis to go muck around in U.S. foreign policy and muck around in the U.S. election and do other things to dig up dirt, fake dirt or real dirt on whoever, you know, whatever other relatives the Democratic nominee has, including if it's not Biden. So I very much think that Rudy's testing the outer boundaries here is you know, maybe it's just Rudy being Rudy to some degree. But I would say it's laying a precedent that if he gets away with this, I mean, why won't some other ambassador somewhere, why won't they say, hey, you know what, there was also corruption here by Elizabeth, I'm making this up, you know, by some relative or friend or donor to Elizabeth Warren or Pete Buttigieg in some other country. And then the ambassador says, I don't really think so. Well, that ambassador's deep state, he or she's corrupt. I mean, you could replay this. And I mean, hopefully it won't work. Hopefully people will speak up. But, well, you know, I think people are underestimating the dangers of the next year. I very much agree with that.
No, I certainly don't underestimate them. I think, but the thing about Rudy Giuliani is he's clearly saying the quiet part out loud. He gives that interview to The New Yorker where he says, I needed to get her out of the way because she was going to stop my attempts to, you know, force an investigation. I mean, this is exactly what the allegation is. The ties between and the links between Trump himself personally and Rudy Giuliani and Rudy Giuliani's smear campaign. This is not a difficult connect the dots. It's totally disingenuous to say that there's no evidence connecting the president to this. Rudy Giuliani comes back from the Ukraine. Think about this scene. The plane lands and, you know, before he deplanes from, you know, on the tarmac, the president of the United States is on the phone saying, what'd you get? What'd you dig up? And Rudy Giuliani says, more than you can possibly imagine. So they're, you know, I mean, this is ongoing. I also think that given the bizarre claims that he is making on a regular basis, you know, this is an argument to get him under oath at some point, not necessarily in public, not even necessarily in the impeachment process, but get him under oath. Because if he's willing to say the kinds of stuff that he's willing to say on Fox in private interviews, imagine what he would say, what an actual under oath interview would be for him and the value of it.
I think that's a good point. I also would point out Congress does have the ability to get under oath and routinely has testified. And I think all testimony to Congress is, you know, subject to perjury charges, whether it's under oath or not. The Secretary of State, the Assistant Secretary of State, various other officials in the U.S. government who can be asked, is what Rudy Giuliani is saying about what's happening in Ukraine true or not? Right. It's not like William Taylor, who's the acting charge, the acting ambassador, in effect, in Ukraine. He testified in the impeachment inquiry. It's not like he can't be called back to testify before the House Foreign Policy, Foreign Affairs Committee and other committees. So I think the degree to which Congress needs to think hard about how much they can minimize, not remove, but diminish the danger Trump and his loyalists are posing, because there are people who are accountable and they're the cabinet secretaries and the undersecretaries and so forth, and get those people back to testify publicly on the record, in effect under oath, maybe literally under oath. I think that's an important role Congress can play as well.
I know it's extremely difficult for public figures to sue for libel or for slander, but I think Marie Yovanovitch might have a pretty good case against Rudy Giuliani at this point, which then sort of, because this is the way my mind works, I keep thinking about Michael Bloomberg and how much money he's spending on this presidential race. If Michael Bloomberg was spending this money educating the public about the information that's already come out about Donald Trump, this would be a tremendous public service. You know, we know that not everybody watches CNN in MSNBC and watches the nightly news, but you know, if Michael Bloomberg is willing to spend $100 million, he could educate the disconnected voter in a rather dramatic way, and I kind of wish that he was. Okay, before we move on here, there's going to be an impeachment vote tomorrow. Obviously, a historic event. This is only the second time in the last 150 years that a president of the United States has been impeached. It certainly looks like centrist Democrats. Democrats from swing districts, including districts won by double digits by Donald Trump, are in fact kind of sucking it up and deciding that they're going to support impeachment. I have to tell you, the contrast between the lack of profiles and courage on the Republican side and these gutsy decisions by Democrats is rather striking to me.
Look, I couldn't agree more. We'll see if there are any Republicans who break with the party. Yeah. The Democrats are sticking with the party, so you could say, well, that's not very courageous. But it is, because these districts aren't great. Now, the good news for the Democrats is the polls are a little bit, you know, there's differences among them. But basically, the public is as okay. If you voted Democratic in 2018 and therefore elected all these Democrats, you're probably okay with impeachment. they want to be reassured, if you voted for that Democrat, that he or she is also doing things about other issues. But they did pass their prescription drug legislation. I don't know anything honestly about it, so I don't know if it's good or bad, but it sounds like it's going to reduce prescription drug prices. They're keeping the, they're going to fund the government, it looks like, for the rest of the fiscal year. And they're passing the Mexico-Canada trade deal. So I think Pelosi's done a pretty good job, I've got to say, of letting these Democrats go back home over Christmas and say, you're right, I voted for impeachment. Maybe some of you don't agree with that. That was my honest decision based on my look at the evidence. But I also want you to know I'm concerned about your drug prices. I'm concerned about jobs and so forth. So I think they're in pretty good shape, honestly.
What do you think of Carly Fiorina's comments yesterday to CNN that she's decided that she thinks it is vital to impeach the president, but she still might end up voting for him in November?
You know, I was just talking to, I'll answer it this way, and I probably should go in a minute, but yeah. I was just talking to a very serious and senior Democratic pollster, actually, who said this, that the strongest argument among weak Republicans, and obviously Trump's got 2/3 of the party just locked up, but among the remaining third, maybe half of that third, is pretty hostile to Trump, actually, and open to defecting to the Democrats. But the third who are sort of sticking with Trump but don't really like him much or understand some of the arguments against him, the strongest argument for them is look at the Democrats. And in that respect, Carly Fiorina is mimicking them. I think what she said is sort of incoherent. People are sort of making fun of it because it's like you think it should be impeached, but then you think maybe it should be reelected. But the degree to which weak Republicans who don't support Trump are, and this isn't foolish, of course, are very worried about Elizabeth Warren and taking away health insurance, very worried about the Green New Deal, very worried about left-wing radical aspects of the Democratic Party. That's actually the best Republican talking point. They're not using it. And they used it 2, 3, 4 months ago and did some helped stop some of the erosion from Trump. I'm sure that'll come back next year. So I think Fiorina, leaving aside the kind of incoherence of it, is reflecting something. The Democrats need to reassure swing voters that they're not crazy in 2020. That is the single most important determinant of the election.
I could not agree more strongly about that. That argument, you know, the what about the Elizabeth Warren? As bad as Trump is, we kind of already know this. So we have the known awful versus the unknown awful. And we saw how that played out in 2016. And there are swing voters. I know that some folks on the left are trying to convince themselves that there are no voters in play, but in fact there are, and those are the voters who are going to decide who gets 270 electoral votes. Bill Kristol, it is good to have you back on the podcast. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.